This is The Big Web Show, everything web that matters. This show is hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman and Dan Benjamin. That's me. This episode is brought to you by MailChimp.com, powerful email marketing. These guys have been instrumental in getting 5x5 to where it is right now. I just want to say thanks very much. We wouldn't be here without them. We certainly wouldn't be here without you guys listening. So please take a second and visit MailChimp.com. They've got something they call the Forever Free Account, which allows you to send 6,000 emails per month to 1,000 subscribers. It's free. It's always free. You don't even need a credit card. So whether you're a designer yourself or you don't know anything about design, you can just plug in your content, use one of their awesome templates, and it just works. So go check them out at MailChimp.com/5x5. So thanks again to them. And hello, Mr. Jeffrey Zeldman. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Dan. How are you?
Doing well, and as always.
How do they do that? How does MailChimp? How do they give you 6,000 mails for free a month?
That's, It
doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I don't know how they do that, but
they're crazy.
Yeah, it is a little. It is crazy. They are chimps. That's how they do it.
That's it. Well, I'm very excited about this show. Our guest today is someone I have known for about 4 years. Had the pleasure of knowing a multi-talented writer, designer, thinker, amazing person, Mandy Brown. Mandy is a co-founder and editor of A Book Apart. And when I say editor, that means when Dan Cederholm wanted to write a book of poems, she said, no, I think CSS would be better. I mean, it's... She helps the authors really hone the narrative and get it, because A Book Apart is a very focused mission, and she helps the authors focus. She also does book layout, working with Jason Santamaria. I mean, really does a lot of different stuff at the company, and actually handles when people say that the customer service at A Book Apart is amazing and really nice, that means that they've been dealing with Mandy, because clearly they weren't dealing with me. And she's a contributing editor for List Apart and community and support manager for Typekit, and a frequent writer for Typekit, becoming one of the voices of Typekit. If Jeffine is the live in-person voice of Typekit and Jason Santamaria is the visual voice of Typekit, Mandy is becoming the written voice of Typekit. She's also an editor, publisher, creative director with 10 years experience at WW Norton, which is a leading independent and employee-owned publisher. And while she was there, and that's really where I met Mandy first, she did everything from creative directing the website to writing about design to designing books and working with the back end people and with e-commerce. Really just an amazing person. And it's a pleasure to know you, and welcome.
And
we're
out
of time. But I want to thank you for coming by today. We're out of time now, but. Hi, how are you? Have you done
all
your
Christmas? I'm good. How
are you? I'm great. Have you done all your holiday shopping?
I have. I have done all of my holiday shopping.
And cooking? You're a gourmet chef.
Amateur gourmet chef. I'm going to make cookies. I've made some cookies. I'm making more cookies in time for Christmas, and maybe some other things as well. So.
Oh, nice.
So there's cooking in my future.
Are these would you call these the granola, wheat-free punishment cookies? No.
No. I think the most
sweetened only with fruit juice cookies. And stuff?
No. These are cookies that are mostly made of butter. And butter and sugar being the two key ingredients in a cookie. Flour is kind of optional, I think.
I believe that's also the two key ingredients in human life.
Yeah. That might be true.
That's good. So let's talk, before we talk about what you do now, which is so many interesting things, we met, I think it was 4 years ago when Happy Cog was working on a redesign of WW Norton's site. And at that time you were the web creative director or the creative director?
It was a little bit of both. So I was leading the project on the website, but I was also creative director, for a lot of the college books at the time as well. So I always kind of I started off doing kind of print work there and kind of migrated to the web. And in independent publishing, when you get a new job, you generally keep your old jobs. So I still had a lot of involvement with the print work as well.
And you, now W.W. Norton is a very revered, respected, and somewhat, not in terms of politics, but somewhat conservative, traditional business. And when I met you, you were wearing a shawl, you had short hair, you were in glasses, and you were definitely vibing librarian, kind of, right? And then, and we went into your office, and then you took off the shawl, and it was like this red dragon tattoo, this, I was waiting for you to say, "Do you see? Do you see?" Which is, of course, a quote from a dragon, but...
It's not actually a dragon.
It's no, but it, you had this like full body. I don't know what it was.
Yes,
you had this like phoenix eating the sun. I don't know. D.H. Lawrence meets who's that? Anyway, it was a very intense tattoo which you revealed without, and I was just like, "Whoa, who is this person?" And that's, I think that's a metaphor for everything I know about you. Like in that moment, it was like, you think you know who this person is, but you really don't, because there's always another layer and there's always another skill. There's always another talent. So you are at Typekit, and let's talk about that. How did you happen to get there, and what do you do there?
Well, I've known about Typekit since the beginning, since obviously Jason's been involved with them since very early on, and have used them and liked them. Sometime this summer, they were looking for someone to kind of lead up their community effort, and I was looking for something new, and Jason and I talked about what it was like to work over there, and he said it was amazing, and he put me in touch with Jeff Veen, and I chatted with him and Brian Mason, and they asked me to come on board. So what I've been doing is kind of the community effort is partly kind of building a proper support system for them, making sure their customer support is as good as it can possibly be and it is exceeding everyone's expectations. And then also it's a lot of content strategy work. So we're building up a lot of content on the blog and soon elsewhere we want Typekit to be a kind of educational resource for people about type on the web. And so we're working towards that and I'm kind of leading that effort.
That's very smart. Can we, and you're involved with Typedia as well, correct? You do?
Just as a kind of volunteer, there's a few of us who kind of volunteer to help with Typedia. So I was kind of, I haven't done anything for them super recently. Eric Voorhees has been leading that lately. But I've been involved in kind of putting them together with partners and doing giveaways and things like that to promote Typedia and also kind of be involved, get it involved with people in the industry.
Typedia, for those who don't know, is a Wikipedia-like entity created by Jason Santamaria, but with a lot of people. Coy worked on it, and a lot of people have worked on it. It's Sean Inman, I believe, and I'm blanking, but I know Dan Mall, I believe.
Yeah. Lou Stanzico, I think, had been involved
Stanzico,
with it.
Stanzico, right. Yeah. A lot of people, smart people. So did that have something to do with your being an appealing candidate to Typekit? Or, I mean, what did they say? What made them say, "Wow"? Did you do the Red Dragon reveal, or?
they only hired me because of the tattoo. No, I mean Jeff and I had a long talk, and I think they were really looking for someone with a kind of editorial eye who could kind of bring that to the company. I think that felt that was missing, and they were also looking for people who were really enthusiastic about type and understood what type on the web meant, and could kind of be involved with that in a very meaningful way. And I think I hope I fit both of those two criteria. So let's
stay with Typekit just for just a few moments and talk about the two aspects of what you're doing. You're doing community and you're doing customer support. Customer support is really important, but a little less interesting or a little more. Let's start there. Do you listen in when their customer support people, do you supervise all the emails that go out? What exactly is it that you do to help them really nail their customer support?
Well, right now I'm doing a lot of the support. We're going to be hiring so that there'll be more people involved with that. The support volume isn't fantastically large. Type Kit's pretty easy to use. Right. So it's not, it's everyone in the company does support. That's one of the kind of company goals. So I delegate things out and get everyone involved and follow up on things and make sure everyone is taken care of. And I'll be bringing in people to do a lot of that work so that I can supervise it. And a lot of it is, you know, making sure people are getting the help they need. It's also, I think, really important to kind of understand why people are writing in and see if you can change things so that they don't have to reach out for support. So, you know, if you're getting one of the kind of principles that I have is if you're getting a lot of questions about something in particular, it means that there's something going on in the product itself that needs to be corrected, that there's kind of a mismatch between what the user's expectations are and what the product is doing. And so we kind of look at ways to kind of take the data that we derive from the support process to make Typekit better so that people don't have to reach out for support. Because ideally, no one should have to come to us for help. They should be able to do everything on their own and not be ever be frustrated in that experience. That's kind of the ideal goal.
Sure. Walk us through an example of one of the rare times where you actually do have what kind of problems do people have on Typekit? Are they expert user problems, naive user problems? What are they?
It's both. I mean, there are a lot of people who write in and say, oh my gosh, my fonts don't work, and it's because they have the CSS wrong. That's fairly common. And so one of the things we're realizing is helping people through the kind of trickiness of figuring out which selector you should be using is something that even an expert can get tripped up on sometimes, and is definitely a common problem with people who are not quite as experienced with HTML and CSS. Those are kind of some of the issues. Some of the issues
So you'll end up debugging someone's CSS for them and saying, oh, see, you've got an enclosing div there and you have to, I mean, do you do stuff like that?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So writer, designer, CSS debugger. Okay. Another problem, like I'm more on the expert end. Someone having a problem with a glyph not showing up, or they don't like the way a font's displaying, or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who write in with questions about type rendering across different systems. So how a font looks on a Mac can be really different than how a font looks on Windows, and a lot of people aren't aware of that or understand why. So I actually, we talk people through those things. What I actually also worked with Tim Brown, who wrote a really epic series of blog posts on the Typekit blog about how fonts render on the web and why they look the way they do in different environments, and to kind of, you know, make sure that people understand what's going on there and how we're working to improve that.
As designers, we've encountered a client being upset that, you know, in Windows XP with clear type off by default, a beautiful font that was designed to look font just fine in that environment looks kind of jaggy. And we'll be, well, everything looks jaggy. And we'll go, and if you switch back to Tahoma, that looks jaggy too. And they're like, yeah, but that's the jaggy our customers know. And this is a new jaggy.
That's common. Windows XP being the one that's most frustrating because that's where clear type is off.
Right.
But it is possible to hint fonts, and we're working with a lot of foundries to kind of improve the rendering of fonts so that they look good even on Windows XP. The Adobe fonts and the FontShop fonts in particular have been really expertly hinted and look. They don't look as good as they do on a Mac as they do in Windows XP, but they look really good for
Web
Windows
type
XP.
Also, I know David Berlow, mm-hmm. It's like he's like doing a Sistine Chapel basically with tweezers. I mean, he's
yeah.
I know, yeah.
So we're working with our foundries to improve that where it's possible. It's also interesting. I mean, some of what people expect type to look at is based on your own experiences. So, Tim Brown talked about recently on the blog about how, I think it was the first version of Safari for Windows shipped with a special kind of type render built in that made fonts on Windows look like they do on a Mac. And Windows users hated it. They thought it was blurry. It wasn't what they were used to, and they kind of rebelled against it, and now Safari still ships with that, but it's off by default, so nobody even knows it's there and probably bothers to turn it on. So
which is weird, because actually a lot of Mac users felt that way too at first, right?
About
before we found
Safari. Or about, yeah. right, around about Apple's rendering in general. Yeah, but now we're all used to it, and we all think Mac's rendering is superior to everything else. So some of it is just about, you know, what you're accustomed to. So Windows users, I think, are accustomed to something in particular. And I've heard, you know, we think that at Typekit that Direct Write with Internet Explorer 9 looks fantastic and yes, so much better than other Windows. And we're really looking forward to the fact that in the future, all of this kind of cross operating system rendering stuff isn't going to matter as much, that between the different rendering engines and the fact that all of our screens are becoming higher resolution, it's not going to be as much of an issue. But there are a lot of people in the Windows world who think Direct Write looks terrible because they're used to something else. So
So you're perhaps the wrong person to ask, but it's 2014. IE9 is the dominant browser on the Windows platform, or IE10, will we still need Typekit? In 4 or 5 years from now, will we still need Typekit? What will Typekit be good for?
Well, I think Typekit is good for, there's still a lot of kind of issues in terms of setting a font up to work that, you know, because Windows XP is going to be with us for a while. And Typekit allows you to get fonts onto your site really, really quickly and really, really easily. That's kind of one of the kind of core values that it does. You don't have to worry about how this works in different browsers, getting it to work on mobile devices, which are all completely different. Like, we're taking care of all of that really complicated stuff for you. And the other issue is that I think from a licensing standpoint, Typekit provides a solution where we have foundries who can make fonts and actually get paid for those fonts, which is really important. If we want good fonts out there, we need foundries who are going to be able to earn a living from those fonts. And Typekit can kind of connect those to the designers and agencies who want to use those fonts on the web. I think that licensing arrangement is going to continue to be really important.
See, that's why they hired you. That was excellent. So let's talk about the community. What you're trying to do for Typekit in terms of creating community or expanding the community they have. It seems to me there's a lot of designers who love web fonts and go to meetups and so forth, but there isn't any particularly focused place where web designers with that passion meet or go. So there's an opportunity for someone to do very well in that space. I assume that's one of the things Typekit wants to do, is sort of, you know, own that conversation, or not own it, but be a hub for that conversation, mm-hmm. be one of several hubs for that conversation. And what's your plan for helping them get there?
Well, a lot of it is producing a lot of content for those people. So there isn't a lot of really good writing about web fonts and about web typography out there. So we're kind of really focused on providing that content. So the blog has been the first step in that, and we're going to be looking at providing more of a permanent place for a lot of that stuff that can be a resource for people who are learning about web fonts or learning about typography in general. A lot of people who started designing on the web may be really great at the latest CSS3 tricks, but they're not really sure how to choose a font or which fonts look good together or you know, how to determine if a font's going to work at small sizes versus large sizes. And we think that we have, you know, we have an ability to help people through those decisions and provide that kind of context that they may not have gotten elsewhere. And we also think we can be a kind of repository for a really great type for people to take advantage of. So a lot of it is around content and giving an opportunity, giving things for people to talk about. I think the series that we've done on type rendering has been really important in that way, and that people just did not understand what happened when a font was displaying on your screen. And we did a ton of research. All the developers and Tim Brown and other people did a lot of work on figuring out how that actually operates and then sharing that information so better people can understand what that means going forward.
And are you going to, just when you say a more permanent place for that, are you talking about a wiki or a separate website or
Separate section underneath the Typekit website? We're going to have a section called Learn that's going to kind of be a place for kind of ongoing content. So the blog is great for kind of timely things, kind of periodic things. We want to give a place where it's not going to just be buried in, you know, blog posts from 6 months ago. We want to have a kind of permanent home for that stuff that we can keep current so that, you know, when you come to it, you're always going to have the most up-to-date information as far as the technology goes, and also just be a resource for people.
Do you Are there plans to work with existing web design communities, SitePoint, ListApart, Smashing Magazine, 24 Ways, that kind of thing?
Well, we're sponsoring an event apart next year, I believe.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, and you know, so I think we're going to be doing, you know, meetups and things like that. So I haven't totally sorted out those kinds of partnerships yet, but it's possible that we could be doing some of those things. Yes.
Okay. Would you be writing? Would Tim Brown be writing a column for SitePoint or Smashing Magazine or something like that? I mean, that kind of cross-pollination.
Possibly, yeah. We've talked about some stuff like that, yeah.
Okay, cool. And what could we expect and when could we expect it?
In terms of those kinds of...
Yes, those kinds of things.
I do not know right now.
Okay. Okay. Are there secrets that you can't talk about that we could hear about now?
Let's see. No.
What's going on in the chat room, Dan?
Well, I actually have a question that kind of started with a quote that something that you wrote on your website. Great book design is invisible. It gives form to the text such that you could imagine the words no other way. And I'm skipping to the next sentence here. You describe, you say, I've sought to achieve these same qualities with the design of this site. And it's interesting to me because these days with fonts available with Typekit and so many options out there right now, I'm still seeing so many of the same font choices and typefaces used over and over and over again. I'm not saying you do that on your site, but for so long, we were stuck with Verdana and Georgia, and there's such a limited set of choices to use. And now we have all of these fonts at our disposal. And yet, again, I almost feel like there's a few designers out there setting trends, and everybody then just uses those fonts. So maybe we've gone from 3 or 4 web fonts to 10, but we're still seeing those 10. Why aren't we seeing 50? Why aren't we seeing 100 out there? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something of once you've seen something a bunch of times, it becomes familiar, and you want to work with that. So I think there are some people who are saying, "Oh, this is a great font that I saw this other guy use, so I'm going to use it now." I'm sure there's some of that. I think we have potentially thousands of fonts, but there are some that render better at small sizes than others. So I think people are gravitating to certain fonts that render especially well because they see, oh, this looks really good on Windows XP, whereas something else particularly at small sizes may not. So Proxima Nova is one that I think has become really popular this year, and it's a beautiful mm-hmm. font, and it looks really great small sizes. And so it makes sense that you would gravitate to that if you were just starting to experiment with web fonts. It's something that you've already seen out there, and that also renders really spectacularly well. It's something that you're going to want to work with. And there are a lot of fonts, I think, that will need work to render well on the web, and that's happening very slowly. It takes quite a lot of effort to make a font that was created for the page for print to actually look good on a screen. And that's happening, but it's not happening maybe as fast as the speed of the internet would like. But we're getting there.
So Mandy, what do you think of the state of typefaces on a lot of the portable readers like the Kindle and the Nook and things like that, where the font choices are significantly limited, sort of the opposite of what you have in the space of a printed world, where truly you can pick any font that you right. want and you can print it, whereas in the Kindle, all of those intelligent choices that you might have made, and I love the Kindle, I just want to say that, but all of these choices that you've probably pained over as a publisher, as a type designer, as an author, even trying to pick the font that you feels accurately represents your writing, that's all sort of thrown out the window, and now you're back to this maybe one or two font choices at the most on a device like this, and in some cases, right. user-settable font. So what's your take on that?
Well, on the latter case, I think users should always be able to set their own fonts. I mean, that's what the web is like, and that's something that you have to let go of. If you've come from print design, you know, print design, you get to control everything that happens. Everything the user sees, you have had pretty much complete and utter control over. And the web, you just don't have that. And that's okay. And so if someone needs a bigger font or they really hate the font you pick, they should be able to change that. And I think that's okay. You should let go of that. That's fine. It's something that they want to do. At the end of the day, the content is more important than the design. But I also think that, you know, in the future, I hope that those devices become more open. There is a component of the EPUB spec. I think the newest version supports font base. So if those device makers start to support that newer version, which who knows how long that will take, but then there is the opportunity that people could embed fonts into eBooks. And when you got your eBook on your Nook or your Kindle or your iPad, you would get the design that the publisher intended. And I think that's great. There's an opportunity for all sorts of fonts for those devices. I mean, it could be, I don't know what the parameters are, like what makes a font look really good on those devices necessarily, but the screens are getting higher resolution, so I think there's an opportunity for lots of really good fonts to be used there if that spec is adopted. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I'm still one of the questions that I have, though, and this is being echoed in the chat room right now, is, you know, Josh, a regular listener of the show, he's saying, you know, you can't do any other sort of experience design on eBooks. You can't really affect it in that way. I mean, with the predominance, though, of eBooks and eBook readers, whether it's on, you know, on the iPad or a Kindle or whatever device is out there, what is then the role of the publisher, if not just to put the words in an electronic format? I mean, does that redefine how we think of publishers starting in 2010?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the traditionally one of the big reasons why you needed the publisher was because you didn't have access to the distribution. So that part has basically been changed. Anyone can publish an EPUB and put it out there to sell. And anyone who's willing to put in a lot of hours can actually set up even a print distribution model, because printing books and shipping them out isn't actually all that complicated. It's a huge pain in the butt, but it's not all that complicated if you're willing to put in the time. So that I don't think is what distinguishes a publisher anymore. I think that part has changed. I think that the editorial attention, however, is almost more important than ever. We're all reading more. I mean, people say people don't read on the internet, but I think that's everyone reads. We're all reading more than we used to, and we want to read good stuff. And the kind of editorial process, both in terms of an individual piece and figuring out like how can this book or this essay be better on its own, and also how it fits in with other selections. So the way that we're putting together a whole list with a book apart, like what does it mean for each of these books to kind of sit on the shelf next to each other? And if you've read these three, what is going to kind of complement that reading and take you on to something else that you wouldn't have expected. I think that kind of editorial attention is what makes publishers still relevant. Authors are better when they have an editor.
What do publishers, in your opinion, need to do to succeed in 2011? And what kind of publishing companies will win?
Hmm.
Well, I think the biggest change that's actually going on right now isn't so much the shift from print to digital, because it is right now digital books are being sold and marketed in more or less the same way through a lot of the same partners. So it's still through Barnes & Noble or Amazon. And they're still being written and kind of composed in the same way. None of that has really changed. I think the really big change right now is actually that the bookstore is kind of bottoming out in some way as a focal point for publishers, and that you don't really need a bookstore in the same way that you used to. It used to be that there was just no way to get a book out to someone except through the local bookstore, which, you know, where your local bookstore owner knew you and knew when you came in what kind of books you were going to want and knew how often you came in and could recommend things to you. That kind of hand selling that happened at your local bookstore was really, really valuable to a publisher who couldn't be in every city in the world at the same time. Well, that's changed. Any publisher can connect with anybody all over the world through the web now. And so I think the value that a bookstore provides or takes, because most bookstores get 60% of the book price, it's just not there anymore. So if I were advising someone in terms of building a publishing house or adapting an existing publishing house, I'd say you really want to connect directly to the reader. There's no reason that the publisher needs to allow a middleman into that process. The publisher should be talking right to the reader. And that means everything from a kind of support issue, but also hearing from them directly about what is interesting to them and what books they need and what information is lacking and what arguments are compelling to them or not, and having a really, really close relationship with that readership, you're going to be able to publish better books. And you're going to reach out to those people and be able to sell them in a way that is both more profitable for the publisher and the authors, and also I think just more compelling and meaningful for people on either side of that.
So just like on the web, build your community, talk to individuals, treat every member of the audience as an individual and not just as an audience, but as a co-participant.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah, I mean, that's what we've been doing on the web for 15 right. years now. And
I think A Book Apart has been successful because A List Apart was there for 10, 12 years before we started with A Book Apart. There was an audience right. that had already kind of learned a lot and read a lot and was interested in what A List Apart had to say and was eager for that content. So I think that's why we've been able to do so well off the gate.
But if A Book Apart had published the wrong books, edited wrong by the wrong authors, books that weren't oriented, it would have just hurt. You know, you can kill a brand. AOL was once an amazing brand, and Netscape was an amazing brand, and Microsoft was an amazing brand. They're still healthy, but they're not where they were. And, you know, and A List Apart is nothing to those brands. But the point is that you can take something that has an audience and a mind share and just destroy it by being inept in the way you extend.
If you're in day-to-day contact with that audience, I think you're less likely to make those mistakes. I think having that kind of one-on-one contact and hearing from people really directly means you're more likely to really empathize with what people are looking for and understand what those needs are than if you're a million miles away. So I think one of the dangers, what scares me about traditional publishing is I think there are a lot of traditional publishers who are putting out fabulous books, but they're not talking to anybody who's reading them. They have no idea who it is who's buying their book. They've lost that connection, and they're not even sure if some of them realize that's a connection that they're missing. And I think that's what I think is more deadly towards the kind of traditional publishing model than the digital change right now.
Because I was going to say that the big publishers don't even have to worry. The big publishers with the mass market books will just keep making the mass market books, and they don't care, and it'll be fine. They'll succeed. It's the little.
They may not be as big as they are in the long run, but
right. But in a way, a company like Five Simple Steps or A Book Apart is competing to some extent with an O'Reilly or a New Writers, which also addresses a niche audience. It's not like O'Reilly and New Writers are huge, right? It's not like Friends of Ed or whatever, or, you know, it was, you know, had millions of readers and was writing blockbusters. It's niche audience. It's small. And so what does the, and as you've said, it's not the fact that it's digital. So what's the nature of the close personal relationship? How does that work and how does it scale and what happens as companies grow? How do they continue to succeed?
I think it's really hard for a very large company to do that. I think that's kind of one of the things that is interesting to me, is that I think small publishers are able to make that connection in a way that a really, really large publisher cannot. And I think it might be better in the long run if were lots of small publishers instead of a few really large ones. I mean, the houses that put out the best books tend to be the ones who are really engaged in a small market and understand that market really, really well. So at least as far as nonfiction goes, fiction is different because there aren't small markets in fiction in the same way. And again, to genre stuff. So the great American novel is not a niche thing. And we obviously want publishers who are putting out great American novels.
The great American novel is a niche thing though. The great American novel might sell 3,000 copies if there is one.
It's hard to corner who those 3,000 people are. You know, it's like at least with A List Apart or something, what Five Simple Steps is doing, like we understand our demographic in a way, like we know what they do for a living and what they're interested in a way that like it's harder to do when you're selling the great American novel. So I don't have any clever answers about if you're trying to publish the great American novel. But I think if you're publishing nonfiction on a topic, being small is an advantage because you can stay in touch with people and you can be kind of nimble and adapt as the industry that you're publishing for changes. I think that that's actually really key. If you're so big that you can't make that connection, I think you're kind of putting yourself in trouble.
Well, being small generally is a really good thing in any economy, and especially in this one, which, I mean, I don't even know how to describe this in the jobless recovery or whatever this is, because, you know, as long as your overhead isn't too high, you don't have to worry about laying people off and all that. You can just stay small and focused and deliver a really good product to the small group of people that need it. I mean, that in a way, our whole community is a bunch of creative people making products that they're selling to each other. I don't even know how that works. It's like a whole bunch of doctors and lawyers working for each other, and somehow I don't really know how that works, but it does. So what do you do when you're not no. Let's talk about books a little bit more. How do you determine if a book is right for, I mean, I'm part of this too, but what's the process? If someone's thinking, because I'll see on Twitter, someone's thinking about writing for a book apart, what would you say that we are looking for, and what might sound like a book for us, or what might sound like a definitely not a book apart?
Let's see. Well, one of the key things, because we're writing short books, is whether or not the topic is something that can reasonably fit into the kind of size of books that we're talking about. So in the vicinity of 100 pages with a small trim size, does it seem like the kind of topic that could fit in there? So
a little bit more than a lecture.
So it's kind of the scope of the topic. Is it focused enough that it's going to kind of work in a way that's compelling and doesn't feel like you just kind of left a lot of stuff out in order to make it short? Because we don't want books that are artificially short. We want books that are naturally and intelligently short, that because they're focused. So I'm looking for that. I'm looking for topics that are timely to web designers today. So if you're working on the web right now, what is a topic that you need to know about that you may not have time to read 700 pages on? So HTML5 and CSS3, I think, are going to both really obvious solutions in terms of if you're building websites for the web right now, you really need to know what's up with these new specs and understand how you can start working with them today and get some sense of how things are going to change in the very near future. And I'm also looking for really strong writing skills. So I think that we are going to edit these books, and that's, I think, a huge part of it. But I think working with someone who is naturally a good writer makes for, you know, just a much more compelling read at the end of the day. So, you know, we're looking for people who are kind of multi-talented. They understand the technical issues, or they have something to say about a particular part of the web industry, but they also know how to tell a story and can write that story in a way that's going to be compelling and interesting and funny and a good read. I want our books to be a really good read, not just informational.
Do I have to be famous, internet famous, community famous, and a big name in the industry in order to write for a book apart?
I think it helps. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but I do think you have to have been writing about your topic already. So if this is something, if you come to me and you say you really want to write a book on X and you don't have a blog and you haven't been writing about this, you haven't been talking about it, it hasn't already been kind of part of who you are, then I'm probably going to say no right out the gate. I want to see that this is something you've already been involved with and are already talking about out there, so that you know how to take it to the next level. You're not just kind of starting out with something that just kind of popped into your head that morning. So I don't think you have to be famous.
So I've go ahead, Mandy. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I had a somewhat related question coming in from the chat room that people keep asking me to ask you. And the question is, if someone reads a lot but isn't really into writing, how can they contribute to smart conversations that they find on the web?
I think you have to become a better writer. If you're going to contribute in that conversation, I think you have to be writing. If you're a really good reader, then you probably know more about writing than you think you do already. And the more you write, the more comfortable you become with it. I think writing is one of these things that's like a muscle. You have to do it every day, or very close to every day, in order for it to feel kind of natural and easy, and in order for your skills at it to get better. So it's something that I think is really important in terms of participating in that conversation. I also really believe in writing as discovery. And if you think you have something to say, but you're not writing about it, you probably don't really know what it is you have to say yet. The act of writing is what kind of makes you understand for yourself what it is that you're talking about and what you have to contribute to that conversation. So if you're just kind of sitting back and listening to things and kind of keeping them to yourself, if you're not actually writing them, I don't think you are going to fully understand for yourself what it is that's interesting to you. So I think that's valuable, you know, both personally in terms of understanding how you fit into something and why something is meaningful to you, and also in terms of contributing to that conversation.
That's fantastic. Can I ask what's going on with a working library? Are you still writing there?
I am still writing. I've been really busy. So there's been less writing, but my New Year's resolution is to write more. So there will be more writing. I have a bunch of pieces that are kind of longer pieces that are kind of in draft form now, and I'm going to have some time over the break to kind of focus on some of that stuff. So there will be more writing in the very near future.
Cool. Do we have more burning questions in the chat room, Dan?
Well, there have been a handful of them, one of them I think that people have been sort of, I don't know if it's a specific question, but they've been talking about you saying the future belongs to editors. Maybe you can elaborate on that. I mean, if the future belongs to the editors, what then is the role? How are editors changing the way we consume the web? And what about completely unedited things like Twitter? I mean, how does Twitter fit in, or something like Twitter fit into this space?
Well, I think, how do I want to come about this? I think we're all, the way I think about it is that we're all doing a lot of reading. And the more we read, I think the higher our standards become for what you're reading and the less patience you have with things that aren't written well. And so I think editors have two roles to kind of play in that process. There's an ability for editors to both take something that someone else has written and make it better, make it more readable, make it more compelling, make it clearer, make it, you know, work with an author so something is more timely and is the right scope and so forth. There's a lot in terms of the actual kind of editorial process on a piece of writing itself that I think makes everything about the web a better experience. And I think that you're seeing with kind of increased conversation around content strategy that a lot of businesses realize that publishing is part of what they need to do to talk to people and engage with an audience. And editors are really important in terms of making that process happen. And I also think that, that there's a curation kind of role with editing as well. People, I think, often say curation, editing kind of as if they're the same, and it's not exactly the same, but I think there's a role in terms of a lot of what an editor does is say no, like we're not going to publish something, or we're going to cut this part out. And since we have an abundance of things to read and consume every day, editors who can kind of do that and say, this is the most important thing for you to understand right now. You're not going to understand everything there is to know about this topic, but this is the most important thing for you to know, I think is really, really important. And I think if you look at like what Jason Kotke does, Jason is an editor on the web. He has a variety of interests, and they're broad, but understandable if you spend some time reading them. And he finds the most interesting things about what's going on in any of those topics and provides them in a way that you can kind of grasp and engage in, but aren't completely overwhelmed by. I think that role is really, really important as we migrate to the web, and the amount of content that we could potentially read gets larger and larger.
So the role, the editor as filter.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the roles. Yeah.
Yeah. John Gruber, a lot of people talk about Apple, but John Gruber seems to know what's really important that's happening with Apple right now and have a perspective on it. And it's partly his perspective and partly his ability to find whatever bizarre article in whatever horrible journal that nobody else would read just to find that gem.
He finds it, and he also puts it in context, which I think is really important. So there might be something that if I had stumbled upon, I wouldn't really understand what it meant in the context of what was going on with Apple. But John has that kind of ability to kind of focus in and let you know, like, this matters because of this other thing. So being able to kind of make those connections and filter things out so that you can focus on what matters, I think is really, really important.
Mandy, how do you manage your workflow, and how do you manage the multiple projects and things that you've got going on? The chat room is demanding that we ask you that. They're really curious. I mean, and I'm also curious. I'll add something to that. Do you work from home? Do you have an office? And how does that affect your workflow?
I have a co-working space in Dumbo. So that's me and Jason Santa Maria and Swiftmas and Workshop and Oak and some other smart people all kind of hang out there. And I work there most of the time. Sometimes I work it from home as well if I really need to kind of be totally on my own, or the weather's foul and I'm too scared to go outside. But I work really hard. I work a lot of hours. People ask me, like, how can you possibly get all this done? And I think one of my answers is that, you know, other people have kids and they spend lots of time with their kids. I have two jobs or three jobs, depending on how you want to count it on any given moment. So I do put in a lot of hours. I just kind of stay focused and keep a to-do list of everything that I have to get done and just kind of plow through it every day, and try to make sure that I take breaks so that my brain has a chance to rest before the next thing happens. So I don't have any secrets. I just work hard.
Jeffrey, I think we're about at the end of our time. Yep. Here. What do you think? Can we wrap? Is there anything else you wanted to ask before we
There's go? Lots we could, but it's time.
Okay.
It's time. So Mandy, thank you. Where can people go if they want to find out more about you? You've got a workinglibrary.com.
Workinglibrary.com.
You've vowed to do more writing there. They can go to twitter.com/aworkinglibrary, and we have that yes. URL up. Under your name there, so that's you do Twitter a lot, and you Twitter about recipes and cooking and food and, wonderful things like that. So you should follow her there. And what else are you working on that people should know about that we can share?
I think that's all I'm going to share right now.
Okay, but maybe some more things coming soon in your future. So stay tuned to Mandy Brown. For updates, I guess, right?
Yep.
Okay. You're very secretive. You're not giving away a lot of information about what you're working on. But yep. That's okay. It's your right. I mean,
mystery. Total mystery.
What I'm working on, you already know. So a list apart, a book apart, type kit. Like,
no, she's
so
a mystery and an enigma with a candy shell.
That's right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Mandy. Thanks, Jeffrey, as always, for co-hosting here. And we want to say thanks again to MailChimp.com. And thanks, everybody, so much for listening. We won't have a show next week because it's between the 25th and the 1st. But join us again in the new year. And we will be right back here, same time, same place. So have a great new year, everybody. Thanks.